The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening. Yeah, so such a pleasure to be here. And you'll see that Padachara is sitting behind me. I think she's scheduled to go down to the Insight Retreat Center tomorrow. So this might be one of her last views up here at IMC, but she'll be down at IRC when that becomes open. I think Gil had mentioned it's hoping that with the air being a little bit more moist down there, it can help mitigate some of the cracks that have started to show up a little bit here. For those of you who don't know, Padachara is a renowned teacher from the time of the Buddha. She it's captured in some of the Buddhist scriptures, the suttas, some of her teachings, as well as how she came to the practice and her awakening experience. And so this is captured or preserved, maybe I should say, in this collection of poems, which is the first anthology of women's literature in the world. So this is the oldest literature that's attributed to women. And it definitely has a feminine stance, some feminine feel, some of these verses. If I remember correctly, I think there's 72, maybe 73, I'm not sure, different poems. And the different poems, some of them have just a single verse and some of them are quite long with many verses. And many of these are their awakening poems. So what they exclaimed when they became awakened, enlightened. And so it belongs, this type of literature, this type, these verses belong to a type of literature that is said to rise up out of joy and euphoria. So often they're like exclamations. And sometimes the verses are seem as if she's saying something out loud, like making an exclamation in a conventional way we might think about it. Or sometimes we could interpret it that somebody's speaking to her, maybe the Buddha. So we might imagine that either somebody is, but we also just might imagine that she's bringing to mind some instructions that she heard. And this is what kind of helped support her and move her towards awakening. So in this collection of poems, it's called the Terigata. There's a number of different translations available. If you're interested, you could always Google it. T-H-E-R-I, Teri. We don't pronounce the H. It's a word in Pali, means like an elder, but it's feminine. Tera would be the masculine, and Teri is the feminine. And Gata is verse, we could say that. So Terigata. G-A-T-H-A. So in these verses, the women describe their emotions, their thoughts, and some of what they did that led to their awakening. And these women are individuals who chose to ordain, so they were nuns, and which makes sense at that time in ancient India. If you really wanted to dedicate your life to practice, of course there weren't meditation centers and there weren't dharma books or things like this. So if you wanted to dedicate your life to practice, you ordained. This is true both for the men and for the women. But some of these women, they include those that are born into abject poverty, as well as with limitless wealth, tremendous wealth. Some that were tired wives, complaining a little bit about their husbands, and some who were desperately in love with their husbands. Includes daughters that were left orphaned, and it also includes mothers and grandmothers who lost their children. So a lot of suffering as part of these stories. Maybe I'll say just a little bit that in the Buddhist scriptures, there's a lot of prose and a lot of verse. And there are certain collections that are nothing but verse, the Terigata, the Theragata, Dhammapada being some examples. But it's also not uncommon that some suttas, there'll be a lot that's in prose, and then with kind of like a capping verse where the Buddha says, kind of like summarizes some of the main teachings and puts that into verse. So there's this two different styles of teachings that are preserved in these two different ways. And so some of the teachings are, as you know, if you've been studying Buddhism or listening to a number of Dharma talks, are very kind of like pedagogically or like teaching. The second factor and the Eightfold Path is wise intention, and wise intention has three elements: renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness. So, you know, kind of a list. And sometimes it's really helpful for us to have some very clear guidelines, some lists that delineate and make it clear what's being spoken about. And sometimes there's some really provocative or evocative similes and metaphors that are part of the prose. But also, sometimes there's a part of us that could use maybe not so much clear guidelines or instructions, but to be touched, to be inspired, to feel something differently or understand something differently than just how we might, than if we were just hearing a list of things or hearing a story or something like this. So in this way, it's going to be a way in which this different style that has preserved maybe is intended to touch a different part of us. Maybe that's one way that we can think about it and can consider it, these verses. Not too long ago, Gill published an article. I'm saying the word published. Maybe that's too strong a word. But he wrote an article that talking about beauty. And he was translating the word kalyana as beauty. You might be familiar with this word kalyana from the expression kalyanamitta, which we often translate as good spiritual friends, but could also be translated as beautiful friends. So this sense of beauty, this a spiritual beauty we might say, is a real part of the Buddhist practice. It's an invaluable way in which we can inform our practice and can be a companion, a foundation, a guide to practice. Because when we have this inner beauty, or we tune into a sense of what is touching and what is beautiful, it can teach us, we can learn from this and teach us the freedom from maliciousness, the freedom from possessiveness or conceit, to align with what's beautiful. So not so much what's aesthetically pleasing, not what's pretty, but qualities that lift the heart, qualities that inspire the mind, maybe inspire the heart. So in the suttas, kalyana is closely associated with virtue and goodness. So to have a beautiful heart is to have a virtuous heart. To have some inner goodness is to have some inner beauty. So in this way, beauty is more of a feeling or more of a experience than like just an intellectual idea of what's the aesthetics or something like this. And I mention this because I want to introduce the idea that maybe some of these verses can touch, are beautiful and can touch us in some kind of way. And then before I share some of these verses from the Terigata, I'll just make a small comment about translation. So translating a verse in Pali is has its own set of challenges, or maybe I could say also opportunities. just in the exact same way in English poetry. Sometimes we use poetic forms of words that we don't use in conventional language, or maybe there's turns of phrase that you only find usually in poetry. It's the same with Pali. So in Pali verse, you find archaic forms of grammar, archaic forms of words. And in addition, just like how Shakespeare is in, I think it's iambic pentameter or something like this, in the same way, Pali verse, it has a very particular meter. So this means that the composer of the verse has to choose their words to meet the meter, you know, which verb is long and which, I'm sorry, which syllable is long, which syllable is short. So in order to make it meet the meter, they might like not put the verb in or not put in a noun and just kind of assume that you'll figure out that they meant the noun that was from two lines earlier or something like this. The reason why I'm saying this is because if you're to look at some translations, you'll see that they are really wildly different. It's possible to have that and yet still be true to the Pali, just because Pali verse leaves the opportunity for lots of different interpretations and translations. And I know certainly when I go to translate some of these verses, sometimes I don't even know where to begin. Okay, so I'd like to read this poem from this nun, and her name is Dhamma, or they call her Dhamma. You know, Dhamma is Dharma. We can understand, as you know, this word in lots of different ways, maybe the teaching, or maybe a mental state, maybe the way things are. And in this poem, we see that moments of clarity or moments of transformation or understanding can arise when we least expect them. And maybe that's true for many of us, is that when we're not trying so hard is when something new can happen. This is why we often have new ideas in the shower, right? And in this poem, the woman Dhamma, she sees the danger in what can happen when we are really identified with our bodies, with our physical forms. She recognizes that our bodies will always fail us in some way eventually. Sickness, if not sickness, then aging. It's just a natural part of what it means to have a body. And so when we let go of our obsessions with our bodies or our strict identification with them, then a certain freedom can arise. So here's her verse. It's very short. And this is a translation by Bhikkhu Sujato. And so she's a nun, and I'll say, their food from lay people who support them. They get alms food. So here we go. I wandered for alms, though feeble, leaning on a staff. My limbs wobbled, and I fell to the ground right there. Seeing the danger of the body, my mind was freed. It's quite something to feel unsteady and to feel yourself falling, and then in that moment to find freedom. I don't know, for me, I feel touched by this. And this recognition that, right, it's not that she was sitting upright in some beautiful meditation posture, but instead she was just in her daily life, wandering for alms, gaining the food for a meal. So recently there's been a book, I think it's called The First Free Women by Maddie Weingast. who, inspired by these poems, writes his own version of them. They are not literal translations, but an inspiring contemporary interpretation of them. So now I'll read his inspired poem after hearing that one. Another day, walking in circles with an empty bowl, leaning on my staff in the middle of the road, my whole body shaking with hunger. What little strength I had left me. As I was falling to the ground, I saw. I was the spoonful of rice, and this whole world, the bowl. You can't miss, even if you try. This last line, you can't miss, even if you try. Yeah, that's something that helps us to feel maybe a little bit bigger, a little bit less that there has to be a small self that's striving to get things just perfect. Instead, with the Mariwangas, kind of also points to that awakening doesn't have to happen in any particular way. So here's another poem, another really short one. This is the nun is named Chitta. You may know this word. Some of you might be familiar with that expression, bodhicitta. So chitta is often translated as a mind or heart. And it's translator's choice whether they use mind or heart. They didn't make a distinction in ancient India. And Chitta, she sits down to rest after making some great effort. And she sits down and then becomes awakened. And in some ways, for me, this brings to mind the story of the Buddha, who also made tremendous effort. And then he became emaciated, right? He was fasting and practicing some extreme asceticism. And so he was probably weak and feeble himself. But he ate a little bit, but then went to sit and then became awakened. So for me, I feel kind of like an echo of that in this poem. It's from the poem, the Nun Chitta. Again, this is the translation by Bhikkhu Sujato. Quickly as an aside, I'll say if you're interested, you can find Bhikkhu Sujato's translations of the Terigata at suttacentral.net. Okay, so here's Chitta's poem. Though I'm skinny, sick, and very feeble, I climb the mountain leaning on a staff. Having laid down my outer robe and overturned my bowl, propping myself against a rock, I shattered the mass of darkness. That's quite something. We can understand the mass of darkness as ignorance. So she shattered ignorance. For me, I like this idea that she's leaning against a rock, which is steady, and we tend to think of them as really solid. And then we have this verb, I shattered. It feels very evocative and powerful. And as I said, in the same way, like the Buddha, a lot of effort and then not so much effort. So again, here's Mary Weingast, who, inspired by that poem, writes this. Somehow I kept climbing, though tired, hungry, and weak, old too. At the top of the mountain, I spread my outer robe on a rock to dry, set down my staff and bowl, took a deep breath, and looked around. It was windy up there. As I was leaning back against a large gray rock, the darkness that I had carried up and down a million mountains slipped off my shoulders and swept itself away on the wind. I'll read that last part again. The darkness that I had carried up and down a million mountains slipped off my shoulders and swept itself away on the wind. This heaviness that we carry on our shoulders, with the wind just being carried away. I feel touched by this movement towards letting go. Such a big part of the Buddhist practice, of course, right, is to stop clinging or grabbing, but to let go. So here's another poem by another woman. Her name is Sama. And this one includes direct references to the Buddha. So as opposed to maybe evoking or reminding us of some of the Buddha stories, she speaks of him directly. So here's the translation by Bhikkhu Sujato. In the 25 years since I went forth, I don't know that I had ever found serenity in my mind. I had failed to find peace of heart or any control over my mind. When I remembered the victor's instructions, I was struck with a sense of urgency. So here the victor is the way that she's referring to the Buddha. Though subject to so many painful things, I have, through my love of diligence, reached the end of craving and fulfilled the Buddha's instructions. This is the seventh day since my craving dried up. So she's pointing to her love of diligence and how that was a support to her, and bringing to mind some of the instructions that she had heard from the Buddha. So now here's Maddie Weingast's interpretation of this. After 25 years on the path, I'd experienced almost everything except peace. When I was young, my mother told me that I would find true happiness only in marriage. Remembering her words all those years later, something in me began to tremble. I gave myself to the trembling, and it showed me all the pain this little heart had ever known, and how countless lives of searching had brought me at last to the present moment, which I happily married. Can you imagine? We've been living together ever since without a single argument. It's kind of a delightful way to think about this, to marrying the present moment and then not arguing. It's a nice way to think about what it means to be awakened, is to not be fighting with the experience that we're having. And then I'll close with this one, a very short one. This one, her name is Vera. Can be sometimes it's related to the word virya, which we sometimes translate as energy or as effort, but it can also be a hero or a warrior, something like this. So I'll read this and then I'll unpack it a little bit. So this is by Bhikkhu Sujato. And it's in the third person. So we can imagine either she's remembering this or maybe this is somebody that's speaking to her. She's known as Veera because of her heroic qualities, a nun with faculties developed. She bears her final body, having vanquished Mara and his mount. So I like this idea that she's heroic and has effort and energy, and she has these heroic qualities with faculties developed. Some of you may know that Virya is one of the five faculties. So she's somebody who has been practicing and has been cultivating and developing them. The expression, she bears her final body, means that she won't be reborn. That's a characteristic of somebody who's completely awakened. And she's having vanquished Mara and his mount. Some of you might know the story of Mara, who is the personification of obstacles, difficulties that get in the way of awakening. And there's a story of Mara riding an elephant, goes into battle with the Buddha, and it's like shooting arrows at the Buddha, and the Buddha converts the arrows to flowers in some kind of way. So in the same way that the Buddha became awakened, Veera did as well. So I'll end with the Matty Winegass, how he was inspired by this. Truly strong among those who think themselves strong. Truly unafraid among those who hide their fear. A hero among those who talk of heroes. Don't be fooled by outward signs, lifting heavy things or picking fights with weaker opponents and running headfirst into battle. A real hero walks the path to its end, then shows others the way. A real hero walks the path to its end, then shows others the way. So may our exploration of some of these verses, some of these poems tonight, may they inspire you in some kind of way, maybe touch something, maybe there's a little bit of beauty there, and may it be a support for you and your practice, so that you may walk the path to its end and show others the way. Thank you.